Welcome to the Coalition for Physician Wellbeing's podcast, The Wellbeing Connector, where through our guests, we explore ideas for making healthcare a better place to work and serve. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Today, I'm thrilled to have two guests on the podcast, Joan MacArthur Blair and Jeannie Cockell. They are co-presidents of Cockell MacArthur Blair Consulting. They profoundly believe that education is the most powerful force for social and economic good in the world. Together, they have more than 50 years of experience in higher education and have taken that experience to build a consulting practice. They specialize in collaboratively designing strategies to surface the wisdom of individuals, groups, and organizations in order for them to build positive futures to respond effectively to change. They have co-authored many articles on resilience, leadership, appreciative inquiry, and published two books, Appreciative Inquiry in Higher Education, A Transformative Force, and Building Resilience with Appreciative Inquiry, A Leadership Journey Through Hope, Despair, and Forgiveness. Okay, well, thank you, Joan and Jeannie, for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you both on the podcast today.
Lovely to be here, Michael.
It's lovely to be here this morning.
So I came across your work because of your book, Building Resilience with Appreciative Inquiry, A Leader's Journey Through Hope, Despair, and Forgiveness. I'm not sure our audience really knows a lot about what is appreciative inquiry. Can you give us a little bit of a background on what it is and how it's applied?
Sure, I can start with that one. Appreciative inquiry is really a way of being and doing in the world. And so just as all of us are certainly physicians, we have our work that we do, and as we do it, we are being a certain way. And I'll just define what appreciative inquiry means. It means to inquire, of course, because inquiry is to be curious, to ask questions. And so, you know, all of us, and especially physicians, so that's what we're doing all the time, right? We're inquiring. And the appreciative part adds a way of looking at the world that we often lose. As people who are basically with scientific backgrounds, we get very, very good at looking at what's wrong and how do we fix it. And that's really important. And the appreciative layer says, well, don't forget the parts about what's already working, because we want to get more of that. So the appreciative part of the inquiry is to say, look also and predominantly at what you're doing well. What are the strengths here? What has gone well in this moment? And what has been well with this problem we're trying to fix? How has it worked in the past? Has anybody fixed it before? How did that work? And how can we all learn from that and increase the value of that, because we're actually appreciating it in that notion of appreciating in value. And at the same time, appreciate means to be fully aware. So we don't ignore all of the things that are part of what it is we're inquiring into and trying to fix and trying to make different and trying to go into the future with a better solution, building on also what's working well, not forgetting about what's working well. So appreciative inquiry is focus on what's working well in order to get more of that and then build on that and build beyond. Often when you just fix problems, they come to status quo. You fixed it, right? Yeah, but how could it be even better? And so the appreciative inquiry is very transformative in the sense of building on seeing what's working well in order to actually get more and beyond into the future.
So as appreciative inquiry practitioners, you've gone into organizations and helped them with appreciative inquiry. Can you talk about the methodology about what you guys actually do when you go into an organization, helping them with appreciative inquiry exercises?
We do all kinds of different works with organizations. We do we work with teams, often teams in trouble who are struggling to do the work they want. And we use a whole variety of methodologies. But fundamentally, we seek to understand what people feel good about in their work and then ask those questions. Okay, so if you have that in even the tiniest of ways, how is it we can bridge to a future that is different than the one you have now? And so we do that work. We do large strategic planning work. We do consultations. with entire organizations who want to talk about how they want to be in the world. And so we do an incredible amount of different kinds of work. And of course, topical to this podcast, we do a lot of work around appreciative resilience. This idea of how can we take this idea of understanding what is powerfully right in the world and inquire into how we might be more resilient using that same methodology. And so we do all kinds of different work for organizations in the world. And we love our work. We love the opportunity to sit down with people and be relentlessly curious about how they might do their work in the future. And so appreciative inquiry is a powerful tool to do that.
And you mentioned that you focused on appreciative resilience, and resilience has, again, you wrote a whole book on the topic. What led you go from appreciative inquiry to focus on resilience?
Well, we found that the work we were doing, say, for example, strategic planning or team building or any of the specific things that we've been called in to do with the clients, that by the end of it, people were going, wow, there's a shift in how we are together. And they didn't use the word resilience, but we could clearly, Joan and I, as we are observing what has happened, kind of a meta layer beyond the actual concrete, thing that we're hired for. And there was this layer of resilience. And we had a kind of struggle with how we were using the word resilience. Because sometimes people think, oh, you just pull your boots up with the, bootstraps and then carry on. But that's not how we use resilience. It was more like a layer of people seeing their strengths and being supportive of each other. And then individually, the resilience for themselves, and then as leaders, especially helping others, would be resilient. So we had to spend a lot of time as we were writing our book, especially, and as we were doing our research with leaders, to really dig into what it means to be resilient. Because, sometimes right now people are saying, well, resilience, people just think you just have to get up and pull up your socks, right? Like it's more than that. And so we got, of course, then deeper into what resilience was made up of, which is this notion, these notions of hope, despair, and forgiveness. But Joan, do you want to add to that, or?
Well, I think for both of us, but for me in particular, I've been fascinated for a long time by what allows people to sustain in complex times, and really that's where we started. And Jeannie and I, we approach the resilience work with what we call grace and courage. Jeannie and I are educators. We're not psychologists. We're not doctors, and we really want in our resilience work to kind of seed a conversation about the possibilities of understanding hope, despair, and forgiveness and its impact on resilience. And so we really talked a lot about how, as a couple of educators, what do we have to contribute to this conversation around resilience? And I've been personally fascinated for a long time about what allows people to sustain. I grew up on a farm, and for any of folks out there who've grown up on a farm, they know this cycle of the constant work it takes to sustain when the hail comes and destroys the crops, and you have to start again. And so even as a child, I became fascinated with what allowed some farmers to kind of keep on going in the hardest of times. And so this has been a long arc interest for me. And also, just to add to what Jeannie said, sometimes people would come to us, we'd be out there doing strategic planning using appreciative inquiry, and people would come to us and say, the work you're doing is really powerful for the organization, but I'm not okay. I'm struggling to do my work at this moment. And we had more and more people kind of coming to us saying, what does appreciative inquiry have to offer me in terms of my day-to-day getting through what's in front of me? And so we undertook to actually sit down and talk to leaders about who are, we're already appreciative inquiry practitioners, about the nature of resilience.
Wonderful. So I want to get into one of the main parts of the book is discuss each about hope, despair, and forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And I'll start on hope. And I was wondering, Joan, if to start, when we talk about hope, one of the, your chapters begin with poems that you've written about a number of the, about these types of topics. Can you start us with just going through your poem about hope?
Sure. And we set the chapters up with these pieces of poetry because sometimes the metaphor helps people understand the idea that we're getting at. This poem is called Hope, of course. My beautiful friend, Hope, you point me toward the sun. You shelter me in the rain. You trumpet my successes and hold me in my sorrow, ever whispering, rise up, rise up. And I think for us, and I'm sure Jeannie's going to add to this too, this that hope for us isn't that it's all going to be okay. And I know most of the people who listen to this podcast are physicians and they work with people every day, many of whom are not going to be okay. So for us, hope isn't about that it's all going to turn out fine. Hope is about finding within circumstances something that is compelling, that helps people understand what is happening to them right now. And we found when we talked to people about the nature of hope, it really is the practice of hope. That even in the most complex of situations, to seek to understand what small things might be hopeful, what could happen to create a hopeful view. And so hope is kind of a fundamental practice in resilience, how it is we undertake that in our personal lives, but also how do we undertake that when we're working with other people. What do you want to add, Jeannie?
I just want to add that, you know, hope is the piece that the appreciative inquiry really grounds itself in. When people go through appreciative inquiries, whether it's looking into the best of their organization in order to create a strategic plan for the future, that's hope, right? Because they're saying, well, this is what we're doing well now, and this is what we could do now, and let's vision it even further. So that whole notion of the way appreciative inquiry works in starting with looking at the best of what is and visioning the future and then making it happen, that's where the appreciative inquiry practice is so important in terms of keeping that view. Not so much of, okay, I want this to happen, I'm hoping for that to happen, and that's what I'm holding on to, because maybe that's not what's really even meant to happen, right? So it's about being able to be with whatever it is that I say it's kind of meant to happen, and to be able to see that in the way of almost reframing, because you had hoped this was going to happen and it didn't, this happened. And so how do you reframe to see what it is there that you can then continue that vision for your future based on your hope, practicing the hope and seeing that and seeing what the best of it is.
We often think about hope as kind of the resilience bank. You know, if we practice hope and a hopeful view kind of in our daily work lives, and Jeannie and I really focus on resilience at work, practice hope and a hopeful view in our daily work lives, it begins to build that kind of, you know, what we call the resilience muscle. It just starts to allow us to look at the world with different gazes, you know, that this is one thing, and we look at it this way, we can see something that is meaningful here. And so we think about hope as kind of the resilience bank, in some ways. And so the practice of that is an undertaking of practice, to practice it in the everyday, whether you need it or not. You know, you might be having the greatest flow day, but to practice hope, hopeful view, to ask yourself, how did you generate hope for yourself and others on this day? And just undertake it as an act of practice.
And one of the critiques of not of what you're saying, but what you're saying is confused with is a false optimism. And Pollyanna sort of approach.
Yeah.
And I want to know if you can speak to that a bit, because some people might be hearing this and saying, la, 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 things aren't so great and you got to be realistic. Can you respond to that?
For us, this is one of the most important conversations about hope. That hope isn't about Pollyanna and la, la, la. And, hope is, we have these great kind of iconic examples of hope. And I'll use Nelson Mandela as an example. He didn't actually ever know he was going to get out of jail. He didn't know that he was going to go on and have the impact that he had. But he never ceased to write, to undertake the understanding of his ideas of democracy and rights and equity. And to us, that's really what hope is. It's not this idea of false optimism. It's really the commitment to seeing what small grains of hope exist within the hardest and most complex of times. And so it is a tough concept in that way, because people want to say, oh, well, that's just, that's just Pollyanna. But really, hope isn't about it all being okay. Hope is about seeking to understand and deeply be appreciative in the sense of aware of what is happening and what is possible within that moment of what is happening.
And what do you guys do to help a team or an organization have collective hope? How do you encourage that?
I think the key thing we do is have them converse with each other, because that's what it's all about. It's for them to surface their stories. And if we're talking about hope, for example, you get people interacting with each other, maybe in a small pair to begin with, and then share at the team some of the themes that came from the stories. The storytelling is another very powerful part of appreciative inquiry. It's narrative-based in terms of how you gather your data and how you work with it and how you get people to engage with it. And you see the shift. I mean, I've worked with teams that really have some serious issues going on, and they start in with their conversations around, well, what is it about this team that is actually already going well? What are some good experiences? And people, no matter how hard they have to think, there's always something there that they can share. And as soon as they start sharing, you can see the hope coming, right? Because they start to see each other totally differently. Like, oh, your story is, I wasn't thinking of you like that. They don't say that out loud, but you can see what's going on in their head, right? That they suddenly see that person in a way that is of a common, hopeful view, that they're seeing each other in terms of what has gone well and what's the best of what is, even if it's so small. And then that starts to magnify as then the teams start to share, collect it like with each other, and then they start from there, come up with, well, what is it that's already working well in this team that we've just surfaced? This is what we can hope to build on. So what are some visions for how we could create further from that as a team? It's phenomenal to see that. So it's not us. We're the facilitators. We create the structure. We bring in the questions. We bring in the ways of interacting with each other so that they can actually, it's theirs. It's what they have created through their conversations together. It's quite powerful.
And that's interesting, because what you're saying effectively, it's that participation that's key to really appreciating the hope. You can't really go and tell people to be hopeful. You have to have them participate in the activities.
Exactly. Yeah.
They can feel it, right? They can feel it.
To kind of say this thunderingly obvious, resilience is an inside job, right? But it doesn't happen in isolation, particularly in the workplace. One of the things we didn't say in the beginning about these three ideas of hope, despair, and forgiveness, is that they interlock.
Yeah.
You know, that they don't exist in isolation. And, you know, sometimes when we talk to CEOs and executives about hope, despair, and forgiveness, they joke and say, well, that's my hourly cycle, to go through those three things in an hour. They interlock. And they, you know, sometimes one of them, those circles is bigger than another circle. And so they move in relationship to the ways in which we are in the workplace. And so, so often when we ask people to tell stories of hope, they end up telling stories of despair,
mm-hmm.
because they've had this experience that somehow, and they found the way within it to sustain themselves. And now they tell that story as a story of hope.
So let's talk a little bit about more about despair. Joan, could you read your poem for the regarding despair? And I think it's a nice way to begin this.
So despair is kind of hard to write about. You know, it's not exactly uplifting, and we work with people. It's kind of like a bit of a downer, but it's, you know, it's, it is something we all experience, right? So this poem called Despair. Despair. An angry cry into the silence. This story I will not tell. It is not that you will not listen. No, it is about me. How do I tell you I'm failing? How do you tell, how do I tell you I am lost? How do I tell you not to follow me? How do I tell you I am just showing up? I was once strong, strong enough for everything. My leadership honed by the years, carved by wisdom, emboldened by action. This is a story I cannot tell. Our language of work has no metaphor, no refrain for the dark loss of hope.
And thank you for that. It's, I agree with you, despair is a hard thing to talk about. And one of the consequences of that is we tend to all feel alone in it because no one else is talking about it, and we hear it all in our own heads. So your poem, actually, I think one of the things that's powerful about it is it's so relatable. It's so simple and relatable. And that's why I think it's important for people to speak out about these sort of things. So again, you may feel despair, but you shouldn't feel alone.
Michael, that's such an important point, because we interviewed leaders from all sorts of different kinds of backgrounds and organizations, and they all shared that same notion. Well, we're leaders, and we wouldn't be considered very good leaders if we actually talked about despair. And so they really shared what you've just said, which is the notion of the sharing, which actually people are not alone, but we make ourselves alone. Right. So that comes back to that whole notion of how do you have those conversations where you actually can share in that in a way that you get back to the hope, right? But you got, and as Joan said earlier, you know, often we ask people to tell stories of hope, but they started with despair. And really, that's what draws people. People want to start with it if they're in a safe enough space. And that's the role we bring in as facilitators. It's important that we have a safe space where people can do that with each other and get into that practice of being able to be vulnerable with each other in order to have those kinds of conversations, which allows them to support one another through that despair or alongside that despair and so on and back to hope eventually.
And a couple of people said in their interviews,
yeah,
you know, if your work does one thing, it kind of brings despair out into the open.
Yeah.
That it's okay to talk about despair because we all experience it. It's that thing, you know, I often describe despair as like a bad house guest, right? They show up, they eat all your food, they leave their socks on the floor, they never do the laundry, they won't leave, they won't go away, and they stay until they've decided, oh, I'm going to move on. You know, despair is not kind of one of those things that we can manage. And so much of our work life is about managing things, about leading, about being and doing in the everyday. Despair is one of those uncontrollable things that comes and visits us at 3 a.m. and it stays until it's finished with us. And it's the hardest of the three, because when people are in it, they can't find their way. And in our work, we're not interested so much in the despair. Not that we're not interested in people's stories of despair, because we are, but we're interested in the strengths people use in times of despair. And how is it people can amplify those strengths, even if they're the tiniest thing? Even if they're only able to do kind of one thing, which is just show up. How is it that they can recognize that strength? And in recognizing that strength, does it then give them a second strength and a second one and a second one as they begin to focus on what strengths did I use today to get through? Even though it was incredibly hard, what did I do today that got me through?
And that's the appreciative inquiry. It's a strengths-based approach to looking at your world and the way things are. So,
and also I was intrigued by your concept of despair as a teacher. You know, there in the moment of feeling most down, your optimism, in a sense, is seeing how that made you better, or how it helped you in some way, or what it added to you, and things of that nature.
Yeah, the learning from it.
I also thought it was interesting that you don't push people to publicly release their despair. It's not a therapy session per se. It's more of just recognizing that we all have our despairs and reveal if you wish, but not feel pressure to do so.
Yeah, that's important. And some of that we don't have the background to deal with that, right? And and the conversations with each other, people don't have with each other. People we're working with either can't support in that kind of level of it, but they can share the strengths and the successes they had through that despair, whatever it was. And most of them will end up revealing it anyways, because as I said, people are drawn to that. So we have to be very careful. And when we're training other people to do this work, right, we are so emphatic about, you know, be careful. This is, don't go beyond what your world is in terms of your skills to be able to be there for people.
Because we really, you know, believe that people don't need to tell their despair story.
No.
There are places where they can tell their despair story, their family, their community, therapists. There's all kinds of places to tell that story. But what appreciative resilience brings is that exists there. That despair is that rock. You're picking it up every morning and you're taking it to work with you. And what strength did you exercise today in order to carry that rock? And so, you know, when Jeannie and I started this work on resilience, we really started with the notion of challenging times and despair and the ways in which people use their strengths, which really led us to undertaking much deeper conversations about hope. But in having those conversations about hope, we found people talking about forgiveness. And we thought, you know, maybe we can find a different word than forgiveness, because it's such a loaded word. You know, people ask us whether we chose it for religious reasons or theological reasons, or, you know, we tried equanimity and compassion and a whole bunch of different words. But really, when it comes to resilience, it is forgiveness. It's that recognition that in order to venture and evolve, in order to begin to move from where we are into an evolution of who we will be, there has to be some level of forgiveness in play. So it's these three ideas and how they're moving together all the time that really quite fascinate us. And fascinate us in that people respond to this idea of forgiveness as an act of will and how it interacts with hope and despair.
And forgiveness and the act of will is really just about, pausing and saying, keep holding on to that if I'm going to move on, right? And so it's really about letting go and seeing what can be in order to get back to that hope. You know, it could be forgiving yourself could be forgiving others, but you need to let go of what that you're holding on to, and which continues, of course, the despair. And you need to pause and breathe and say, okay, what can I let go on? Let go here in order to be able to go on.
So basically, to feel your best going forward, you have to let go of some of that negativity that may be justified, may be right, but it's not your best interest to hold on to it.
Yeah.
And forgiveness has nothing to do with justice. You know, we know this from kind of the iconic stories of forgiveness. It has nothing to do with justice, and it has nothing to do with making it right. And most of the time, it has nothing to do with another person. Like, it's not about going and offering forgiveness or seeking forgiveness. Mm-hmm. It's really about having conversations with ourselves about what is here that I need to let go of in order that my gaze can begin to return to hope. I think forgiveness is the hardest. Mm-hmm. To practice hope and a hopeful view, it's not that hard, particularly if you're having a good day. To focus on strengths in times of despair, it's harder, but we can do it. Forgiveness is, that's the powerhouse, I think, in terms of kind of finding the way home again, if we want to call it that.
Interesting. Would you like to read your poem regarding forgiveness?
And I wrote this poem on forgiveness, particularly because people ask us, well, what if acts are unforgivable? What's the relationship between forgiveness and justice? What if I give someone absolution that they don't deserve? And so I think this poem helps people understand how we define forgiveness. There are many definitions of forgiveness, but this poem is ours. Forgiveness is not a blank slate. It does not offer absolution. It does not lighten the burden of past acts. Do not think it is easy, nor is it kind. Rather, it recognizes the power of rising again from the ashes of fires we ourselves ignited, of dousing the flamethrowers gripped by circumstance and evil. It is a letting go and a holding close. It abides in love and champions knowing, and it walks with a steely and willful force. Forgive me. So I think that poem helped people understand what we were writing about in forgiveness, that it wasn't some sort of huggy-huggy, it's all going to be okay. And we talk about forgiveness being the of the practices and resilience, the one we get to do every day. You know, we decide to, you know, forgive today, and then we get to do the same forgiveness again tomorrow because it didn't stick. You know, and it's the one we get to do every day.
I think I took out of it that it's not so much about, like you said, about a given person. It's to be fully present in the moment and plan for the future. You have to let go of some of the negative past. And that's kind of how I think of it. Yeah. We're up to closing, about end of our time together today. Did you guys have any closing thoughts or anything else, reflections you'd like to share?
I just wanted to use the notion of reframing, because I don't think we've brought that up, and it has to do with what we were just saying about forgiveness, is to be able to have a practice of whatever you're amidst is to reframe. So it could be something like letting go and forgiving, in the sense of being able to move on from whatever the situation, the despair, whatever it is. But I think that's a very powerful practice in appreciative inquiry, and it goes back to the notion of being appreciative inquiry, which is to really look at the world in a certain way that you practice, looking for the best, reframing what is not going well into seeking out even the kernel of what is going well and what could be, and seeing the future in a way that is hopeful.
I think the last thing I would say is that we say this often in the book, that resilience is a practice. It is not something we get to arrive at. It's not something we get to say, okay, done and dusted, I'm resilient. And we have no idea as human beings in which situations we will be resilient and which we will not. We can kind of predict them. And there's a lot of, you know, scientists working on that whole field of resilience, of the ways in which our brain undertake to be resilient. And yet there's this randomness to resilience. And so we talk about resilience as a practice, something we need to do in the everyday, regardless of how that day is for us. And that sometimes that practice is easy, and sometimes that practice is hugely complex. And we invite people to, I guess the last thing I would say is we invite people to use our work in whatever way they wish. We wrote this book in the hope that we could seed a conversation about resilience, and in the hope that people would just take pieces of it that resonated for them and use it in their workplace in ways that made a difference for them in the work that they're doing every day.
Well, thank you to both of you. Your work definitely resonates with me, and I've learned a ton from studying it, and I'll share your materials and spread your word as well. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
Wonderful.
Well, that's our show for today. I want to thank both Joan MacArthur Blair and Jeannie Cockell for joining us today and for sharing both their insights and personal stories. Information on their work can be found on their website, cocklemacarthurblair.com. That's cocklemacarthurblair.com. On their website, you can find information on topics such as Appreciative Resilience Facilitated Training. Their next one starts in April, as well as information on free webinars that they do a couple times a year on topics such as the practice of resilience, using your strength through despair, as well as the notion of forgiveness. And you can feel free to contact them on their email at joan@cocklemacarthurblair.com or jeannie@cocklemacarthurblair.com. If you wish to learn more about the Coalition, please visit our website at www.forphysicianwellbeing.org. You can also check us out on LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook. I also want to thank our volunteers and the staff from the Coalition who made this podcast possible. Finally, I'd like to thank Acesis, A-C-E-S-I-S, Incorporated, for sponsoring my time working on this podcast. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and his guests, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Coalition for Physician Wellbeing, its board, or other members of the Coalition. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Brown, wishing our caregivers out there meaning, purpose, and joy in the practice of medicine. Together we are stronger. Until next time.